The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC. The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
My mission is simple, to make you money. I'm here to level the playing field for all investors. There's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise to help you find it. Mad Money starts now.
Hey, I'm Cramer. Welcome to Mad Money. Welcome to Cramerica. Other people want to make friends? I'm just trying to save their money. My job is not just to entertain, but put days like today into context. So call me at 1-800-743-CNBC or tweet me at Jim Cramer. Trillions of dollars were lost today, with the Dow sinking 422 points, S&P falling 0.95%, and the Nasdaq losing 0.84%. Should that decline have happened? Was it a mistake to sell based on one admittedly hotter than expected consumer price index reading, even though that's only because the people setting the expectations seem almost brain dead to me? Tonight, I want to do the unthinkable. I'm going to question the basic premise, not of selling. If inflation numbers truly get too hot, there are many companies that will be in a jam because they're heavily indebted and need to raise money. They want the Fed to cut rates, which it won't do until inflation dies down. These stocks should definitely go lower if inflation gets any hotter, as should the expensive growth stocks that are objectively worth less in a world where inflation keeps eroding the purchasing power of their future earnings. So let's put that aside. The premise I want to question is the accuracy of the index itself, the CPI, which originates from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Because you know what? I think it's suspect. I'm not talking about the absolute numbers. I'm talking about the trend lines, because the trend lines suggest that selling in response to this report may have been and could be a mistake. Remember where I'm coming from. At the beginning of the year, I said the market's consensus estimates of 6 rate cuts was frankly ridiculous. I've repeatedly said that we need either no rate cuts or one rate cut, and that's it. No more than that. Lately, I've questioned whether the Fed stopped tightening too soon, although I can't deny it's been great for the stock market. With that in mind, let's take a hard look at the actual inflation numbers we got this morning that simply, I think, aren't collected all that well and give you little insight into the true hotness of the economy. They overstated how hot it was, to put it in plain English. Let's start with food. What jumps out immediately is a painful jump in meats, poultry, fish, and eggs, up 0.9% month over month, with eggs alone jumping 4.6%. Everybody has to pay for food, so at first glance, this one looks like it could be getting out of control. I say at first glance because this is not an inflation issue. We're having one of the worst outbreaks of avian flu in history. It's an epidemic so powerful that it's crossed over from chickens to dairy cows, and it's threatening to go into all sorts of parts of the food chain. Cal-Maine Foods, the largest egg producer in the country, had to kill 1.6 million chickens and temporarily cease operations at its affected facility in Texas. We don't know how bad this disease is going to be. We do know supply and demand, though. These food inflation numbers, especially the eggs, reflect the avian flu epidemic. It skewed the numbers. But prices would be much lower if these birds were healthy. I wish they could asterisk somehow, but that may explain what looks to be the way too hot number in food. Energy looks suspect, too. The energy index rose 1.1% in March, with gasoline up 1.7%. Let's see. There's a war in the Middle East. That's the war premium. We're also trying to combat Russian oil from hitting the market, which is helpful for Ukraine, but costs us money at the pump. Again, this increase in energy costs has nothing to do with demand and everything to do with supply. So it might be more temporal than it seems. although not so if the war in the Middle East heats up, as many think. As Rusty Brazil, our go-to energy analyst, said just last Friday, these prices will eventually go back down. It's the war premium. Now, here's where it gets really weird. The Labor Department's report said that the price of natural gas was down 3.2% year-over-year in March. Okay, positive, but let's drill here. Natural gas traded about $2 in March of 2023. But in 2024, we have whole swaths of natural gas that are trading for nothing, or even less than nothing, in a strange aberration that's never been seen for this commodity. In some areas, producers are actually paying you to take it off their hands. That's why nat gas for March of 24 came in not at $2, but at $1.50, which is a 25% decline, not a 3.2% decline. Natural gas heats about 50% of all homes. Their calculation at the Labor Department seems inaccurate, and the consequence may be a hotter number than in reality. Now, some numbers are intractable. We've had a post-COVID boom in healthcare procedures, so it makes sense that hospital services are up 1%. Hospitals hired 27,000 people, too. Healthcare in entirety saw 72,000 new jobs created, a ton for any sector. And it makes sense that in wake of the medical care index rose 0.5%. I mean, look, they got to raise prices to cover this labor cost. But some things make no sense at all. How could apparel have gone up 0.7% month over month? This is a fungible category. We've gotten tons of numbers from so many apparel companies, and I follow a lot of them. I can't recall a single instance of a price increase, save denim, which is extremely hot right now. What I do know is that the closeout retailers have had a gigantic amount of business, led by TJ Maxx, which has, they have 1,300 stores. That's TJX. They bring prices down, not up. Again, something's not making sense here for me. Does the CPI report take into account online sellers like the Chinese retailer Temu, which is the second largest shopping app in America as measured by monthly users? They're right behind Amazon. Go there if you haven't. More than 100 million Americans shop at T-E-M-U, Temu. The prices look like something you could have gotten, I don't know, I mean, maybe never. I was thinking like 20 years ago for a lot of it. I mean, just as cheap as Shein with 13.7 million users. You think these numbers are factored in the CPI data? You know, I got to wonder because I think the data would be much lower. I bring this up because some of these online bargains are nuts. If you go right now to Temu, you will see 87-cent men's shoes, lots of 39-cent women's outfits, and men's underwear for 35 cents, and women's shoes for 26 cents. I've ordered from the place. Okay, so my wife said that most of the stuff I bought her belonged in a landfill if it didn't catch fire first. But as long as you don't smoke, I mean, the clothes probably aren't a fire hazard. I mean, what's the deal? Look, I have no illusions about some of these numbers. Shelter's up 0.4% month over month. It should be. We don't have exact numbers, but we've likely added about 10 million people from immigration over the last 3 years. That pushes up the cost of housing. Then, again, it also pushes down wages, which you need in labor shortage. Transportation services like motor vehicle repair aren't going to go down that much. Tough to find new workers in that area, that line of work. But you can join Costco and save 15% on parts and services up to $500. I have no idea how motor vehicle insurance can go straight up, jumping 2.6% in the month mark. That seems outrageous. Is it car theft? Is that what's driving it? Is it something the government should look into, maybe, as it's so off the mark of everything else, say bird flu and influenced eggs? Can you get a lower Costco with their policies from American Family Insurance? Does the Labor Department include numbers from a firm that counts 105 million U.S. members, like Costco does? I'd go get a free quote from Connect Program, which is a subsidiary of American Family, but I don't want to waste Costco workers' time. I'm a member. I'm not going to tax our system. Now, I'm not going to get the Labor Department to adjust its numbers or even asterisk certain things. Just like they haven't been able to outsource the non-farm payroll report to paychecks or automatic data, they aren't going to give me the baton for the consumer price index. But the bottom line, trillions of dollars were indeed lost today under the assumption that inflation is way hotter than we thought. And after examining the numbers underneath, considering the companies involved and the prices they charge, I think that may not be true. These headline CPI numbers do not reflect reality as I see it. Let's just hope Fed Chief Jay Powell agrees with me and not them. Let's go to Matt in Connecticut. Matt.
Booyah, Jimmy Chill.
Yo, Matt, what's shaking, partner?
Hey, Jim. Matt from Connecticut. Wanted to get your thoughts on SoundHound AI.
No. I mean, this thing is, I know what happened is NVIDIA put a little money with it. It spiked up, and then it's been drifting down, down, down. Trades furiously in after-hours trading. I do not think you should own the stock. Let's go to Darcy in Florida. Darcy.
Hi, Jim. Love the show.
Oh, thanks, Darcy.
I wanted to tell you that you're one of the few people that I trust with stock.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
And I wanted to know if I should add more Chipotle stock before the 50-to-1 stock split in June. And do you think CMG will continue to outperform after the split?
Okay, great questions both. Now, I would tell you that I care more about how the company's doing than the split itself, and the company's doing incredibly well. I do know that after the split, I wouldn't be surprised if people got extra shares. They say, oh, I got so much Chipotle, I'll sell some. So I think in the you could buy some here, but in the wake of the actual split, it'll run up into the split, and then it will probably go down. But remember, the split is just to make it so that the employees can get more, you know, a whole share. It will make the stock more liquid, which is what I like. Steven in Ohio. Steven.
Booyah, Jim, and go Knicks as they head into this playoff run.
All right, well, you know, it wouldn't be so bad to see them in, guess, in the tournament. Not my favorite team, but that's all right. What's happening?
Is the stock of Lululemon a buy as they currently trade down?
I've got to tell you, I'm all in Lululemon, and I have been for years, but I must admit that the numbers in the last few months were not up to snuff for Lulu. So I pulled back on Lulu. I pulled back on Nike. And look, I'm even worried about what stock that we own. People know it if you're a member of the investing club. I'm worried about Starbucks. The higher multiple companies that have a lot of business in China that are trading for expensive prices are not working right now. All right. I think the assumption that inflation is way hotter than we think is suspect at best. These headline CPI numbers just don't reflect the reality as I see it. Let's just hope Jay Powell agrees with me. On Mad Money Tonight, small caps are under pressure today after that hot CPI number, but we're capitalizing on the opportunity by identifying five names in the consumer discretionary space, ones that I think could be worth watching here. Then you know I've been focused on the small cap space, but it's the growth stocks that have marched the average higher. But could that leadership be in danger, or could growth be a strong corner of the market worth buying and being patient with? I'm going off the charts for answers. And as the spokesperson for the American Migraine Foundation, I'm passionate about those working on diseases impacting the brain. So I'm hearing how MindMed is working to disrupt the space with the CEO. So stay with Kramer.
Don't miss a second of Mad Money. Follow at Jim Cramer on X. Have a question? Tweet Cramer. Hashtag Mad Mentions. Send Jim an email to madmoney@cnbc.com or give us a call at 1-800-743-CNBC. Miss something? Head to madmoney.cnbc.com.
Fact. Running a business is not getting easier on your wallet. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. Also a fact, smart businesses are reducing costs and headaches by graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See how you'll profit with NetSuite, and then you can think of all the ways you could be spending the money you save. Company retreat in Malibu, anyone? By popular demand, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to NetSuite.com to start saving.
When you're hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging to connect with candidates faster. Plus, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mad Money. Just go to Indeed.com/Mad Money right now and support this show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mad Money. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All week I've said that small caps could become big winners as long as interest rates go lower this year. And while that seems a little less likely after today's inflation reading, I think it's still where we're ultimately headed. That's why I've gone through the major sectors in the Russell 2000, searching for potential winners. And tonight we've got one last group, consumer discretionary. So let me give you my favorite small caps in this retail-oriented group. First up is one you know and watch the show a lot, which is Signet Jewelers, which you know as K Jewelers or Zales, Jared, and a handful of digital jewelry stores under the name Blue Nile. Under the leadership of CEO Gina Drosos, Signet has become a phenomenal turnaround story. The last time we spoke to her in December, she said the business was picking up in large part because engagement rings are a huge part of the business, and the pandemic made it very hard to date. There is typically a 2 to 3 year lag between when couples start dating and when they get engaged, Gina told us. So all those couples that started dating as the pandemic wound down, they should be getting engaged right now. It's kind of interesting, scientific. In late March, Signet reported a mixed quarter, softer than expected sales pair with a big earnings beat. Unfortunately, their guidance was pretty conservative. And then the stock dropped 12% a single session. But that decline turned out to be a bit of a head fake. See, last week, Signet announced a repurchasing of a significant chunk of convertible preferred stock. That's basically removing 4.1 million shares from circulation. In order to adjust, they raised their full-year earnings per share forecast by nearly a dollar at the midpoint because they've now got fewer shares. I say don't overthink this one. The stock trades at less than 10 times this year's earnings estimates. And the turn that Drosos predicted last year, it's only just starting to pick up steam. See, looks real good right here, right now. Second, with the Masters Tournament beginning tomorrow, I've got Acushnet Holdings, the parent company of golf equipment brands like Titleist and FootJoy. This one's got a pretty simple story. Acushnet has premier golf brands, especially with Titleist. And it's benefited from the fact that golf got a big boost during the pandemic when it was one of the safest sports around. The numbers have always been solid here, but Acushnet did offer a conservative full-year forecast when reported at the end of February. They plan to make some investments in product development operations and digital engagement. So the stock sold off nearly 7% in response, and overall it's down more than 10% since the quarter. You know what? I think that could be a gift, though. With Acushnet trading just over 18 times this year's earnings estimates, you know what? You got my blessing to pounce on a pullback. Third, how about Boot Barn? Remember them, the specialty retailer that sells Western and work-related footwear, apparel, and accessories? This is another company that we followed for a long time. I'm a fan, in large part because Boot Barn is chronically underappreciated by Wall Street, as it's not the type of place where Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs analysts tend to shop. The bull case for Boot Barn is an ambitious long-term store growth story. They've already grown their footprint steadily from 86 stores in 2012 to 382 by the end of last year. But management thinks they can get to 900 stores by 2030. Wow. This store growth helps overcome periods when same-store sales are lacking. For example, in Boot Barn's latest quarter, their same-store sales were down 9.7%. But because they opened 11 new stores, their net sales were up 1%. Remember, I care more about same-store. That's the true comparison. We just can't ignore the fact that same-store sales were down nearly 10%. That's truly awful and not at all representative of the Boot Barn that I know. However, I think this will represent the trough for Boot Barn's comps. The company itself projected same-store sales would be down 6.3 to 9% in the quarter that ended a week and a half ago. You know what? I'm hopeful that management will sound more sanguine the next time they report. That would be a nice upward cadence. Wall Street seems to agree as the stock actually rallied more than 10% in response to that seemingly ugly quarter in February. And it's been running higher ever since. It's now almost 38% since the last earnings report. That's very bullish. Still, with Boot Barn shares trading at less than 20 times earnings, I don't think it's too late. I don't think you've missed it all. Now, next, you got one that you probably never heard of that actually excites me because I kind of like the space that it's in. It's called Dorman Products. It's a leading supplier of aftermarket auto parts and components, mostly for light passenger vehicles, but also for heavy-duty trucks and especially vehicles like ATVs. Demand for both new and used autos remains strong, but cars have gotten too expensive. That's good for Dorman because it means people try to extend the life of their own cars. And to do that, they need aftermarket parts. That's one reason this stock's now up 53% from its lows last October. It doesn't hurt that when Dorman reported its latest quarter in February, they gave us an incredibly bullish full-year forecast, talking about 19 to 26% earnings growth year over year. The stock jumped more than 15% response, but I don't think it's too expensive given that it now sells for less than 17 times the midpoint of its full-year earnings forecast. And that's why I'd still be a buyer here even after this run. Finally, there were a lot of restaurants on our list of small cap consumer discretionary stocks. I was picking through each one, trying to find the one that I liked, and then boom, I stumbled on it. It wasn't that hard. It's Brinker International. That's a parent company of Chili's and also Maggiano's. Now, you know that we have CEO Kevin Hochman on the show pretty regularly, and I always come away impressed after speaking with him. He knows exactly what he's doing with this Chili's brand, and he's got terrific execution. that one. Brinker's done a much better job of hiring workers, and he's kept them all during the labor shortage. I've been so impressed with this guy. Our faith has been rewarded with several strong quarters from Brinker recently. Most recently, the company reported a nice earnings beat in late January, with management raising its full-year sales and earnings forecast. In short, it's all systems go at EAT. That's the symbol of Brinker. And you get all this for just 13 times earnings. I've never understood why that multiple is so low. I think the stock's nowhere near done going higher right now. Oh, and you might be surprised to hear that Chili's is the largest seller of margaritas in this entire country, which matters, as we are on the eve of Cinco de Mayo. Bottom line, I've now given you 30 small cap stock picks across the biggest sectors in the Russell 2000. Check them out and see if any of them work for your portfolio. Because while rates went higher today after the hot CPI, I still believe that rates will be lower at the end of the year. And whenever rates do start to come down, I'm betting the small caps will make up for lost time after lagging behind the rest of the market for the past 18 months. Now, we're going to revisit this list from time to time, so keep track with us. We know we've got some real winners here. Mad Money is back after the break.
Coming up, Cramer's taking a 360 look at small caps, sector by sector. What do the charts say about the group in total? Keep it here.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
As you know, I've spent the last week talking up the small cap value stocks because I think they can thrive in a world where interest rates ultimately head lower. Oh, but it's undeniable that growth stocks have led us higher for the last few years. And you got to ask yourself, is it really about the change? Look, the whole small cap series is about searching for additional opportunities. It's not like I want to give up on growth. I mean, come on. So is it possible the growth cohort is simply taking a breather for making another move higher? Can you, these small caps ever go anywhere? I mean, that's the question we got to answer tonight, which is why we're going off the charts with the help of Jessica Inskip, the first woman on the active trader desk at Fidelity, who's now the director of education and product at Options Play. She's also the co-founder and host of the Market Maker podcast. She's had a terrific track record since the bottom last October, a bottom she called almost perfectly. And now she thinks that the small caps look a lot less enticing than a big cap growth plays. Unfortunately, it doesn't jive with our series, but that's okay. We're open-minded, fellas. Just check out the weekly chart of the iShares Russell 2000 ETF. It's a proxy for small cap benchmark index. Yeah, I've been talking about for days now, which trades under the ticker IWM. Inskip points out that the Russell 2000 has met with very strong resistance levels for the ETF, and it's a firm ceiling at 213. You can see never, kind of one great moment there, and then that's really about it. It hasn't been able to jump that hurdle. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 and NASDAQ 100 have already overcome similar resistance records without a problem. For this iShares Russell 2000 ETF, that $213 ceiling originally formed on October 11th of 2021, when the index gapped up and then started running to its previous highs. This was a little more than a month before the Fed declared war on inflation, and the whole small cap cohort just got obliterated. Basically, this is an old floor support that's now become a ceiling of resistance, one that the Russell 2000 just can't seem to clear. And it certainly didn't distinguish itself today, believe me. Meanwhile, Inskip notes that the Russell 2000 ETF has a nice floor of support running from 202 to 206. So you just got to go down here and you see that it's been holding so far. Tight range. Which represents the old support levels from where the index was trading before that final explosive rally in late 2021. That's pretty solid. Though we'll note that with the nearly 3% slide today, the IWM fell below that level to $200 and change. But since she's looking at the weekly chart for the Russell 2000, we'll be watching the close on Friday to see if this support level's been violated. Inskip also points out that the trading cycle for the Russell 2000 is bullish because all of its key moving averages are headed in the right direction, and that's these, okay? However, she's concerned that the trend here seems to be waning, and the moving average convergence-divergence line, or MACD, appears to be making a bearish crossover, and that's right here, okay, where the blue line crosses below the red one. This is a key momentum indicator, and these MACD, okay, crossovers tend to be pretty reliable buy or sell signals. In short, Instacart sees the possibility of downside risk with the Russell 2000, although the charts haven't confirmed it yet. So in other words, we take a look at this whole thing, and what we have to say is she likes the small cap index, how it's performing over the S&P, but I've got to tell you, I looked at this when she sent it in, and I said, man, that's just nothing to write home about. All right, take a look at this chart, which is just a ratio of the Russell 2000 and the S&P 500 over the past 2 years, okay? And Skip points out that the Russell 2000 relative to the S&P 500 has now formed an uptrend. All right, that's the green line. As long as it holds, she's feeling more sanguine. At the same time, though, there's a strong ceiling of resistance not too far from here because it's been hard for the small cap index to outperform the S&P. But Skip likes that it's building a base here. On the other hand, when you look at the iShares Russell 1000 growth ETF, which is made up of 1,000 mid and large cap stocks with growth characteristics, it's running circles around the S&P 500. Take a look at this chart plotting the performance of the Russell 1000 growth versus the S&P. Okay, you can see that there's a clear uptrend with a nice floor of support that's way up high. For Inskip, that means that growth looks better than value here, and growth will continue to lead the way. Hey, by the way, the Russell 1000 growth is heavily weighted to the mega caps. 46% of this index is Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, Amazon, Meta, and Alphabet. Now, how about the tech-heavy NASDAQ 100? Take a look at the weekly chart here. A month and a half ago, Inskip flagged some potential risks in the index. If tech cooled off, she figured we might be in for a period of consolidation or even a pullback. Sure enough, it's been pretty much jogging in place since then. Right now, the NASDAQ 100 has a floor of support at its 13-week moving average. Okay, so when you take a look, you got to go 13, then you look at the purple. There's the floor of support, okay? That's around 17,920, less than 100 points below where it's currently trading. And it's got a ceiling resistance at 18,465. Okay, so that's right here. Now, Inskip likes that the moving averages are sloping upwards, and that's this. However, but the MACD line has a turn for the worse since making that bearish crossover. Again, look, the last few days have been brutal. I mean, all this stuff, if you looked at it a week ago, will look a little better, okay? Inskip predicts the NASDAQ 100 will keep moving sideways or even pull back in the next couple of weeks, but she also sees a mega-cap tech resurgence during the week of the 22nd, because that's when so many of these companies start reporting. Given that the NASDAQ 100 has been leading the way for some time now, she predicts that this could give a boost to the entire market. Now, how about individual stocks? Inskip screened for stocks that are forming a base, have strong trend strength, and also have moving averages that are headed in the right direction. Now, this is really depressing. Only one small cap stock met her criteria. That's a company called Star Surgical, which makes implantable lenses that are used in eye surgery. After being beaten down for ages, Star Surgical now caught fire, and if this $51 stock can clear its ceiling of resistance at 55 and 60, well, Inskip thinks this thing could be run right to 75. That would be pretty terrific, although it's, remember, it's only one. All right, there was also one large cap stock that met our criteria, and I've been waiting for this stock to shine. Maybe it's going to happen. It's called Devon Energy, DBN, the big oil and gas producer. Take a look. For Inskip, this is another good chart. Devon spent a long time trading sideways, and now its stock is acting like a coiled spring. I was very disappointed that it had this downturn. But if it's ready, it can go much, much higher. It just has to catch up with all the rest of the oils. Bottom line, as much as I like small caps with lower valuations, the charts, I mean, wow, as driven by Jessica Inskip, currently seem to favor larger growth stocks, or just be honest, make these stocks feel like they ain't going anywhere. And maybe if you're waiting a couple of weeks, she thinks the mega cap techs can finally make a comeback. But I didn't see anything here that made me feel confident about this group of stocks that we have been profiling. Hey, listen, not everything works. All right, let's go to Katrina in Maryland. Katrina.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I am good, Katrina. How about you?
I am well, thank you. So, Jim, I have a few shares of CNVA, Carvana
okay.
stock,
mm-hmm.
and that has gone up significantly over the past several months. And so I am wondering if it's time for me to sell those. I've noticed that the CFO last week and several other executives sold several shares. And so I'm wondering if that is a clear indication that I should do the same.
Well, look, this is a great question. I would tell you this stock is a rocket ship, all right? And what I do with rocket ship, with kind of a so-called parabolic move, is I take some off the table. All right, I would take some off the table if I were you. No reflection on how Carvana is doing fundamentally, which is just pretty insanely great. But you saw what the market's done the last couple of days. Let's not let that happen to you. Let's take a little off, and then we can, if the market takes it down again, we will feel more sanguine about the situation. I feel like, I missed that. I missed an opportunity to sell. Let's take advantage of this tell and take a little off tomorrow. Let's go to Nancy in Missouri, please. Nancy.
Booyah.
Booyah.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Jim.
Of course, Nancy, of course.
I'm interested in buying some Honeywell stock, and I wanted to know what your analysis of this stock's future growth potential would be, and do you have it in your charitable trust?
Yes, and it's funny. We did buy some ourselves. What we do, just, you know, is we scrutinize on down days. I just bother Jeff Marks constantly. What do we do? What do we do? What do you think? What do you think? How about the Honeywell? How about the Honeywell? And finally, he succumbed. Or another way to look at it is I said, you know what? We got to buy something. This market is so low today. Let's put a little money to work, and we happen to choose Honeywell. All right. The charges, according to Jess Ginsburg, currently favor larger growth stocks over small caps. And if you're able to stomach a potential pullback over the next couple weeks, Inskip thinks that the mega caps can finally make a comeback. And here you know we're speaking about the old-timers, the fangs of the world, the Magnificent Seven. All right, much more Mad Money Head. MindMed is working on anxiety treatment using LSD. And I'm hearing more from the company's CEO about potential applications for this experimental and breakthrough therapy. Then investors hang on the headlines from two important figures in the market, Warren Buffett and Elon Musk. But I spotted an important dichotomy between the two that I think every investor needs to understand. I'll reveal it. And of course, all your calls rapid fire in tonight's edition of the Lightning Round. So stay with Cramer. In light of the doom and gloom in the market today, I want to focus on what I think is a feel-good story. I'm talking about Mind Medicine, also known as MindMed. It's a biotech company that's studying various psychedelic drugs as treatments for all sorts of mental health issues. You heard me right. They're dealing with LSD. Craziest thing is that it looks like it might work, at least in early-stage clinical trials. I want to make it very clear that I'm not endorsing drug use. Say no to drugs unless they've got FDA approval. Speaking of the FDA, last month, MindMed received breakthrough therapy designation for their LSD-based drug program. They're using it to treat anxiety. The stock instantly shot up 50% on the news and is now up more than 80% since the announcement. So is this a speculative story that's gotten ahead of itself, or could it have more room to run? Let's check in with Rob Barrow. He's the CEO of MindMed to learn more about what's going on. Mr. Barrow, welcome to Mad Money.
Thanks so much for having me, Jim. Big fan of the show.
Yes. Well, sir, I've got to tell you, this is very exciting. And rather than put words in your mouth, I just thought you should tell about the results that you've had, because quite frankly, the results are stunning.
Absolutely. It really can't talk about them without putting it in the context of the mental health epidemic we're facing here in this country. And the renaissance in this drug class has really been promising. But our phase two results, certainly we feel are some of the best we've seen out of this field. We saw results where after a single treatment without any other therapy or anything, after a single treatment with our drug in a controlled clinical setting, we saw rapid, within a day, reduction in anxiety and depressive symptoms that lasted for up to 3 months with no real return to baseline. So it appears that a single dose could have really rapid and durable clinical response in what is largely an intractable disease that's not well served by current treatments.
Right now, what people should understand, there is a standard of care that you are up against, Spravato, that is a J&J drug, which is really derived from ketamine. And people can take a drip, they can go to a clinic. But the fact is that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the drip can take a little while, and you've got to do it much more often than you have to dose MindMed.
That's right. So Spravato, which is indicated in depression, but not anxiety at this point, certainly has shown some early uptake. And now J&J is guiding for it to be a $1 to $5 billion drug. The challenge is that patients have to come in for up to 56 treatments a year. And each of those treatments requires 2 hours of monitoring in the clinic. So when we compare that to many month durable effect after just a single dose and spending effectively 1 day in the clinic, we certainly see a significant advantage for the kind of dynamics we've seen in our clinical development program.
Right, and now let's go over, just so people know, this is generalized anxiety disorder that we're talking about, which is different from what they take Spravato, but yeah, I'm using that as a medicine that people are very thrilled at for depression. It's very expensive. Now, this is the one thing that I think people may not understand. There are different kind of queries that you can give a person that will then show about whether they are basically, let's say it, happier than after than not. How did you do on this HAM on the HAM results?
Right. So the regulatory endpoint we use in anxiety is the Hamilton Anxiety Score. And in our study, patients on average came in with severe diseases rated by the Hamilton Anxiety, the HAM-A. They had an average HAM-A of 30 at baseline. And we saw over a 20-point reduction out to 12 weeks after the single treatment. So we saw just a remarkable response, something that's more than double the standard of care, which is primarily SRIs and benzodiazepines, each of which have their significant challenges in both compliance and tolerability. So we've seen better results than we've seen out of any drug that's pursued GAD in the last 20 years.
And it's very important to point out the side effects really didn't seem anything. And frankly, the one I was most worried about, did it have any suicidal thoughts? Nil. I mean, it's pretty special.
Absolutely. There was virtually all of the side effects were limited to the day of dosing and really represented the effects of taking LSD, right? In clinical trials, we have to record those as adverse events, but no one expects anything else when taking a drug that we have known perceptual effects that occur over the course of a few hours.
Okay, so when I looked over some of the research, I was astounded. We actually had many different studies that were done many years ago, and they all seemed pretty positive. And what I was thinking, do you think society just wasn't ready for it? Because obviously they were on a right path when they were looking at LSD.
Right. Before the Controlled Substance Act, there was this incredible body of research, and LSD was the leader of the entire drug class. There was 10 times more research on LSD than any of these other drugs. So we certainly have this historical evidence base that was really remarkably positive. There are cultural pressures and political pressures that really led to putting these promising potential therapies on the shelf for decades. And now we're particularly excited to be bringing those back, to take them off the shelf and show through modern, rigorous scientific research that these drugs actually have promise in treating diseases like anxiety and depression.
Now, would you be looking at a similar pricing to the very expensive Spravato, given the fact that you have excellent results?
Well, what we know is that anxiety is a highly costly disorder. Patients who have generalized anxiety disorder visit their doctors much more often. They require much more medical care. And so by providing durable clinical benefit, one of our hopes is to offset those other costs, to show benefits both on the anxiety symptoms, but also on all the other comorbidities and all the other impacts on things like quality of life, on reduction in workplace productivity, on absenteeism. So these are the real promises and why we believe there's an extraordinary value in a new treatment for GAD.
Now, I mean, one of the things that there's a Rakesh Jain, who's on your conference call, says 31st year in psychiatry. And he said, and I thought this was really important, that he'd gotten jaded over the last 20, 30 years and seeing just incremental or sometimes, you know, side moving interventions. But this isn't one of them. This is a biggie. It's a biggie, not just because it was a one time administration of a medication that itself is quite remarkable, but its effect size. And this man, I don't know him, obviously I don't know you, but that, I mean, usually you don't find doctors who are that effusive about a product.
That's true, and it's representative of, I'd say, a common theme when we talk to practitioners. Rarely do we see clinical results in novel drugs that are in development get this kind of excitement out of practitioners. And it really is a signifier of how poor the treatments have been and how limited the treatment options are in diseases like anxiety. So we feel quite honored to be able to bring this new drug class forward and bring the leading drug in the class back to the front of that pack.
Yeah, I want to make clear people know it's speculative. You have money on the balance sheet. You're not making money. But I want people to know that because I was quite taken by the excitement of it myself. And I want people to know that it is speculative. But I want to thank you for coming on, Robert Barrow, CEO of MindMed, because I just hope this thing works. You know what I mean? We all have to hope it works. Thank you very much. Mad Money's back in for me.
Coming up, hit us with your best shot. An electrified fast fire lightning round is next.
Hold it. Before we begin, I must share this with you. Some exciting news. Set your calendars tomorrow at 10 p.m. Eastern. You will want to be watching my friend Carl's amazing show called Cities of Success, Denver and Boulder. It's fabulous. You will not want to miss it. And now it is time. It's up to the lightning round. And then the lightning round is over. Are you ready, Ski? Dang, time for the lightning round. I'm going to start with John Narza. John.
Hi, Jim. I love your show.
Oh, thank you.
I own Champion X. And it's another day I've offered $8 million in a stock trade to the shareholders. Is that a good deal for about 10 and 9 shareholders on some summer day?
What's the stock? SLB. Oh, yeah, they changed the name. All right, so, John, listen. This is actually funny you mentioned, because this is a stock that literally Jeff Marks and I talked about today. I said, look, maybe we need more oil exposure. Maybe it's Devon. Maybe it's SLB. They've run a lot. We want to wait till they pull it, but I think it's a really great company. Let's go to Jeffrey in Massachusetts. Jeffrey.
Good evening, Jim. How you doing?
I am doing well, Jeffrey. How about you?
Not too bad. On the recent news of a massive cybersecurity breach and the recent share buyback, is MarineMax a buy, sell, or hold?
No. I just think it's just too risky right here. I know the multiple's really low, but I just don't like that sector of the market at this moment. Let's go to Connor in Massachusetts. Connor.
Booyah, Jim. First, I want to thank you and my dad for teaching me investing, so a big thank you for that.
Oh, terrific. Terrific. What's going on?
I want to know your thoughts on Peabody Energy, ticker symbol BTU.
I'm not a coal guy. I know coal is up. A lot of that is to do with just different flows from overseas, but I do not want to own BTU, and I think it should be sold. Let's go to Dave in Illinois. Dave!
Dr. Kramer, my S&P oscillator watching friend, how are you?
I am good, David, and I'm thrilled to hear from you. What's happening?
Jim, this $43 billion S&P 500 component operates a cloud-based platform to assist customers with their digital advertising. The Trade Desk has outperformed the market both this year and the last 12 months. Jim, your take on TDD?
I have to tell you, I like Jeff Green, and I want to tell you that I think that the Justice Department's case against Google is actually hurt by how effective Jeff Green is, because he's such a great alternative to using the auction system of Google. So I think Trade Desk is great. Once again, Dave brings us some terrific stocks. Let's go to Donna in New York. Donna.
Booyah, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Jim, I'd like to know what you think about the biopharma company Geron.
Oh, Geron? Just okay. I mean, we've got so many great biotechs these days. I mean, let's stick with the really good ones. Don't care about excitement. Care about like something like a Vertex. I've made a good acquisition. Let's go to Stan in New Jersey. Stan.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I am good, Stan. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thank you. I'm looking to see what do you think of Archer Aviation.
No. We don't need a vertical takeoff play right now. It's losing a lot of money. It's just too speculative for me. How about we go to Alan in Florida? Alan.
Jimmy Chill, I need you to stop for a minute so that I can thank you and your team for the Investor Club. It's the most entertaining way to learn how to make money.
You like those late ones that we've been sending out till they wake up in the morning? We have been working around the clock. Thank you so much. Trying to send as much as we can, impart as much knowledge as we can. How can I help you?
You know, Jimmy, the AI revolution, it's huge. It's growing exponentially. But there is a concern that it may stall because there's not enough clean, reliable energy to power this revolution. This is why Amazon just paid $650 million for a nuclear-powered data center in Pennsylvania. Uranium demand is booming, and there's no easy supply coming anytime soon. Bank of America just said there's a supply deficit until 2029, and Goldman Sachs seems to agree. When the Russian uranium ban goes into play, domestic uranium will be critical and premium. And that should benefit the stock you gave us home gamers when it was in the twos.
And which
Uranium
one?
Uranium Energy Corp.
Oh, I like that stock. Now, I have to tell you, it is speculative, but it's not improbable. And I think that you're right. 2030 is when we're going to start getting the new ones to come online. You need that company. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the conclusion of the Lightning Round.
The Lightning Round is sponsored by Charles Schwab.
In the last 10 years, we've only had two surefire headline grabbers in our business, Warren Buffett and Elon Musk. Got nothing to do? Find something to say about either one of these guys. That's the easy way to attract eyeballs and keep your journalism job. The coverage has been encased in awe. You want to get right with Buffett. You want to be on the same side as Musk. Getting right with Buffett means loving his annual letter, no matter what, and recognizing the sui generis pilgrimage to Omaha, where folks can still eat See's candies and enjoy all that folksy wisdom. Pure joy. Everybody loves Buffett. Then there's Musk, and he's a different kind of billionaire. There's an awkward dynamic when the press covers him because it's all love or hate. When Tesla's stock is going up, everybody, especially Wall Street, loves the guy. As long as his stock's headed in the right direction, it's pure praise. He's a genius. His cars are phenomenal. Tesla's not even a car company. It's a tech company on wheels. Cybertruck, bulletproof. Look out, F-150. the Rockets, Twitter, now X. No problem for Musk. He isn't bipolar. He's tripolar. He can handle it. Oh, but when the stock's going down, like right now, suddenly everybody has a lot of criticism. All we hear is that Tesla's cars are coming down in price, Chinese competitors slicing into their sales, maybe permanently, because Musk can't deliver a low-cost model. Hertz has too many of them, can't get rid of them. Cybertruck, can't sell them. Bulletproof Aspects, less useful than the F-150. It's kind of an armored pickup Lamborghini. Totally unacceptable for small, medium-sized business owners. And Musk seems completely distracted by the collapse of X, the artist formerly known as Twitter. You hear he's obsessed with himself, the Kardashian of technology. He's a troubled man. So what's correct? How should the media approach Musk? Look, unlike Warren Buffett, it is a tough call. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway has so many levers that it's truly magnificent. At its core, it's an insurance company, a good one, which nobody on Wall Street really cares about. But the business is essential because all auto insurance companies seem to do is raise prices. We saw that with the CPI this morning, and Buffett's Geico is the cheapest and the best. How about Berkshire's portfolio? Apple turned out to be a terrific buy. American Express is taking off. Occidental Petroleum, wow, right at the bottom. A railroad, Burlington Northern, which is still loved, even though it's doing not as well as it should be right now. It can only get better. He's got a terrific pipeline network when those things are suddenly in demand. And yes, he did buy Japan at the lows. The man's bulletproof. But Musk, because none of his other companies have come public, the man does seem as a one-trick pony, and the trick's getting old. With the downgrades and price target cuts, the long knives are really out for Musk. They obviously never liked him. They only liked that Tesla stock was a juggernaut. He's always treated the street with contempt. Well, right back at you. The former sycophants in the media suddenly don't know what to do. If they turn him, they'll never talk to him again, and they'll lose their ability to generate page views. They're joined at the hip, but maybe the hip needs a replacement. My view. Look, even when Tesla's business is faltering and the stock is going down, I always caveat that by reminding that Elon Musk is brilliant. But now there are overtones that he's lost his touch or maybe become more of an evil genius, which I think, by the way, is unfair. But life's unfair. At the end of the day, though, these two men are defined by their stocks. And Buffett is killing it. And Musk is being killed. We're rubbernecking. I say that we have an overdose of coverage on Musk because he makes the irrelevant relevant and the prosaic brilliant. We actually ought to have more coverage on Buffett. The guy's running an empire with truly fabulous lieutenants. His lasting legacy may be that he sure knows how to pick successors. Let me wrap this up by saying that famously, we are in a what have you done for me lately business. Buffett does it endlessly. Musk, nothing that can make you money right now. And no matter what, to the small minds of Wall Street, that's really all that it's about. I like to say there's always a bull market somewhere. I promise I'll find it just for you right here on Mad Money. I'm Jim Cramer. See you tomorrow. Last call starts now.
All opinions expressed by Jim Cramer on this podcast are solely Cramer's opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by Cramer on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Jim Cramer as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. Cramer's opinions are based upon information he considers reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Mad Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Mad Money disclaimer.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.